Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. U.S. Treasury Secretary Benson mentioned a possible gas tax and fueled a debate. Would such a tax fortify or cripple our environment and economy for the future? Persuasive arguments just ahead. Stay with us. Also this time, Defenders of Wildlife 1, Department of Interior 0. And John Helwig's digital clock does not tell time. It counts humans, now up to nearly 5.5 billion.
We are growing at a rate of about 95 million people a year, and that translates down to about 3 people per second.
These stories this time just ahead on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. An energy tax would either lead us into the next century or send us back to the last one. The issue is generating a lot of debate energy anymore following a recent announcement on national television by Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson that the Clinton administration might consider raising the gasoline tax. Without being specific, Benson suggested a broad-based energy tax might be a way to reduce simultaneously the federal deficit and energy consumption. Energy consultant Joel Gordis admits such a tax would be unpopular, but would in fact have several key benefits.
And it depends exactly how it is put to people. Deficit reduction may not be good enough reason for most people, but there are other reasons to couch it, other terms to couch it in, to try to get people to understand the immensity of the problem. For instance, another reason for raising this tax on gasoline are the environmental reasons. In certain states where they need to comply with the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, the costs are going to be tremendous to meet compliance. What's the easiest way to meet compliance? By having people drive less or combine trips with people, carpooling, using mass transportation. Failure to do so means that they will not be able to bring new industry into their states or even expand existing industries. So this becomes another reason. A third reason, to me the most important reason in the whole world to do this, is because it is America's leading, number one national security problem. Presently, we are importing 50% of our oil, and more of it is coming from the Middle East. The Middle East has 71% of the world's reserves. Those countries, none of them, are stable. How much do we want to pin our future hopes on that?
Joel Gordis is an energy efficiency expert and former Connecticut state representative. Debt reduction, environmental protection, and national security, then, are the three leading arguments Gordis advances in support of a rise in the federal gasoline tax.
Well, first of all, the federal government does not need more revenues. It needs more fiscal restraint.
Kent Jeffries, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Jeffries is Director of Environmental Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank Jeffries describes as dedicated to individual liberty and limited government. Jeffries is strongly opposed to a gas tax or any other form of energy tax.
The problem is not one that the American people are stingy or somehow withholding revenues that the federal government could apply more effectively than the average person could. In fact, the federal government is incredibly wasteful and inefficient. So simply pouring more money into that system will not improve it. So that's one point that should be stressed in all of these debates. Secondly, the gas tax is incredibly regressive. It impacts the poor and the middle class to a much higher degree than other economic sections of the economy. The gas tax, in addition, if you're talking about a federal increase in the gas tax, will reduce state revenues because many states depend on state-level and local-level gasoline taxes for much of their revenue base. They use this to fund everything from prisons to public schools. The federal government is talking about reducing gasoline consumption by raising the federal tax. That means that directly the states will lose revenues, and the deficit, the federal deficit, will be shifted onto the backs of state and local government. Another bad reason to raise gasoline taxes. So each of the questions raised, or the supporting issues raised by proponents of a gasoline tax, can be refuted.
Jeffrey says there are no guarantees any new revenues from a gas tax will go toward retiring the national debt. During his presidential campaign, Ross Perot called for a 10-cent a gallon increase in the gas tax for each of 5 years as a way to reduce the national debt. Considering that Western Europeans pay 2.5 to 3 times what we pay in fuel taxes, Joel Gorda says the Perot plan is conservative.
I think that is totally acceptable. That's not tremendously a heinous type of a tax, considering that we're talking, as I said, European taxes that bring the cost up to $3 and 50 cents a gallon. I'd say eventually we're going to have to get somewhere in that neighborhood. But if it's done gradually, I don't think it'll be too terrible.
During the long history of discussion on the propriety of levying such a tax, only recently has debt reduction been mentioned as a rationale. Most of the discussion has centered on energy conservation, the argument being that if we tax ourselves on energy consumption, we will use less of it and raise money for efficiency programs and environmental cleanup. Jeffries begs to differ.
The gas tax is not a green tax. It's a greed tax. Again, they really want your revenues, and they're coming up with very simplistic proposals or excuses to take it. They claim that if we drive less as Americans, we will somehow pollute less. But this ignores the fact that not all cars are equal in terms of the pollution they generate. 10% of the automobile fleet produces over 50% of the pollution. And this is generally cars that are not well maintained or have been tampered with for different performance levels or some of the equipment has broken down. Applying a tax to the fuel is not going to reduce the amount of pollution most of these cars produce. In addition, if we're trying to shift people by taxing gasoline into mass transit, you have to ask, well, what are the returns on mass transit? Almost every mass transit system in America runs an enormous deficit. The most efficient doesn't even cover 80% of its costs. The private automobile is the most effective and successful mass transit system in history. It moves more people farther and faster and more efficiently than any other system yet devised. So when we talk about trying to get people out of their personal automobiles, we're really talking about limiting the mobility of the American population. And that mobility is an important factor in economic efficiency. It enables us to live in one spot, perhaps where there are better schools, and work in another spot where there are more jobs. If you make that more costly, that movement from one place to another, you will reduce American competitiveness, you will reduce American gross national product, and you will reduce the quality and the standard of life of the average American.
At the heart of the energy tax discussion as a way to curb our energy use is the idea that such a tax necessarily and desirably would upset the status quo. The status quo, say environmentalists, being exactly what is not sustainable about our way of life. Gorda says this change will be brought upon us by legislation, for it is apparently not in our nature to bring change from within us. Though in the long run we must rule with our hearts and not by our governments, Gorda says the question is, can we do this?
I don't know if you can until people start to realize that what they know as freedom is tied to their resources. You take away the quality of those resources, you take away the quantity of those resources, and we lose what Americans have always known to be their freedom.
If he were campaigning or signing legislation, Joel Gordis would not hesitate to begin an increase in the gas tax.
I think I'd start it off on a gradual scale, probably within a 2-year period, working it up to 50 cents a gallon. And then, depending upon what inflation was like at that point, adjusting it so that it went up until it was maybe $3, $3.50 a gallon over the next 5 years or so.
Kent Jeffries.
If any politician would step forward and say that we need a $3 gallon tax on gasoline in America, I don't think he'd be a politician for long, because even the average American understands that that is economically ruinous. The federal government does not need more revenues. It needs more fiscal restraint. And that means that if we're going to try and apply some sort of discipline to the market, which is the real excuse for the gasoline tax, if we're going to apply a discipline to the market, we should first apply discipline to the government. The claims, the assertions of politicians are usually taken at face value. We grade politicians on their stated intent. well, they have good intentions, so we should support them. But when it comes to a product that you purchase in the open market, you want results. You don't care what the claims of this automobile manufacturer or this radio manufacturer might be. You want to see this product work as it was intended and promised. We should apply the same standards to the that we apply to the market. We should apply those standards to the government. And if you do that, you'll find that the claims of the proponents of a gas tax fall apart. It will not reduce pollution. It will not improve the efficiency of our economy, and it will not balance the budget.
Kent Jeffries, Director of Environmental Studies at the Washington, D.C.-based Competitive Enterprise Institute. Joel Gordis spoke to us from Riverton, Connecticut. Gordis is an energy efficiency specialist and solar design technician and formerly represented the 63rd District in the Connecticut State Legislature. The gas tax has not yet been proposed officially either from the White House or on Capitol Hill, and this discussion has not delved into the larger issue of a proposed carbon tax that would apply to the broader range of energy use beyond the transportation sector, a discussion for a later date. This is Bruce Robertson. As though clad in armor and riding a great steed, the defenders of wildlife came to do battle. John Fitzgerald is a lawyer with the environmental group Defenders of Wildlife as it brought suit against the United States Department of Interior.
As a result of the settlement, the Fish and Wildlife Service will list over the next 4 years the vast majority, of several hundred candidate species that have been awaiting listing as either threatened or endangered for as much as a dozen years. They will begin with 401 species in a Category 1 group, and they will list most of those in the next 4 years. They will then prioritize the remaining 900 species affected by the settlement and list many of those over the same four-year period and the remainder, hopefully not too many years after that.
The suit was brought by you, Defenders of Wildlife, against the Department of Interior, broadly speaking. Why was this?
Well, we and the Fund for Animals and some other individuals and groups brought the lawsuit against the Department of the Interior because it is the Secretary of Interior who's in charge of listing terrestrial species, and most of these candidates, almost all, are terrestrial species. And he had been failing to do his duty to review these species in a timely fashion and prioritize them for listing. He had been basically sweeping them under the rug and hoping that no one would notice.
As you see them, what is wrong with the tools, or maybe we should call them the criteria, spelled out in the Endangered Species Act, used by the Department of Interior, that had been keeping so many plants and animals off the lists for protection?
Well, they are to assess five different factors in determining whether a species is endangered or threatened. Under Section 4A1 of the Act, they're required to assess the present or threatened destruction of the habitat or range, the overutilization for commercial or scientific or other purposes, disease or predation affecting the species, the inadequacy of existing regulatory mechanisms to conserve the species, and other natural or man-made factors affecting its continued existence, such as the introduction of exotic species, or that basically is a catch-all for things that the drafters hadn't yet envisioned. And they then review whether or not you're seeing an entire species at risk or a subspecies, or whether you're seeing an important population at risk that should be protected, or whether it's the entire existing species on the face of the earth, and various other factors, and prioritize that according to the degrees of threat and the ability of the agencies to affect those things versus the ability of other agencies to affect those. For example, they are to consider the efforts of state and other national bodies to conserve species when determining whether or not the federal government should step in. If there's a very effective state conservation program in effect, then that may be something that they would use to put the species on a lower priority for listing.
Before the battle began, it was over. As you say, the suit was settled out of court after you had filed already. What were some of the developing objections, though, the line of defense being mounted by Department of Interior?
Well, that's a very good question. Luckily, we settled it fairly early on, before they could make a long list of excuses official. The fact of the matter is that their initial defense had been generally lack of sufficient resources to do the job. But even within a certain degree of resources, they have to prioritize their actions to provide the greatest good for the highest need. That is, if they have only a certain number of biologists, they ought to work on the things that are most urgently in need of listing. We found that they were not doing that, that they weren't even complying with their own prioritization system. And therefore, it wasn't really a matter of resources, it was a matter of organizing those resources.
Fitzgerald says many of the species now listed are plants. Many of the plants recommended by the Smithsonian Institute as long ago as 1978.
Most of these things are not things like the Florida black bear, which happens to be on the in the first group. Most of them are things like the Zapata bladder pod, or the hidden lake Bucurus, or the Chinese camp Brodea, things that almost none of us would have heard of. But nonetheless, things that are endangered and important in their particular ecosystems. And this is one of the real, true beauties of the Endangered Species Act, is that it is not something that discriminates against the lesser-known species of the world, but basically says that if it's an endangered species, we ought to protect it, at least not eliminate it negligently.
John Fitzgerald, Director of Wildlife Law at the Defenders of Wildlife, successfully challenging the United States Department of Interior over the size of the list of endangered species of plants and animals. Though Interior is under court order to expand and implement this new list, Fitzgerald expects there to be more progress under Secretary Bruce Babbitt in the Clinton administration than was observed under Secretary Manuel Lujan in the Bush administration. This is Bruce Robertson. This story will be somewhat inaccurate by the time you hear it, but there is little we can do about it. I have in front of me a device, one of only two in existence so far, invented by John Helwig of Berkeley, California. Helwig calls it a world population button. Right now the button reads 5,501,575,163. No, now it's 68. Wait, 172, 75, 78.
What we have is a circular 99. Button which can be worn on a lapel. Pictured on it is the Earth, our blue planet, and in the face of the button is a little electronic display, a liquid crystal display similar to what you have on your calculator, and it has 10 digits on it, and the number that's represented on the display represents the current world population. And the number continues to increase at a rate which represents the increase of population of humans on the Earth. The number actually represents the net increase of births over deaths. So this is a dynamic figure that keeps going up as long as there are more people born than are people dying.
John, you tell us this is one of only two that you have made so far. When you assembled the components at first, how did you decide what figure to use to set the watch? I mean, you didn't start with zero, did you?
Well, the figure 5.5 billion is generally agreed to be representative of world population today. Many studies are done on a regular basis by the UN and by the various census-taking agencies of the various countries. And these numbers are all studied and accumulated by the UN and other organizations interested in population, and that's the source of the figure. What's significant about the 5.5 billion is that sometime this year, generally thought to be around May the 1st or May the 15th, the world population will in fact reach 5.5 billion. And we are growing at a rate of about 95 million people a year, and that translates down to about 3 people per second. And that's the rate at which you see the number increasing on the display on the button.
Mm-hmm, I see. Tell us a bit about the hardware here itself. How did you design the digital counter to count at the rate that we believe the population is increasing?
Well, what you have inside the button are a couple of microchips. The actual logic of the counting is programmed into the microchip, similar to how an electronic watch is programmed. There is a clock inside, essentially, which is a microchip, and with a little bit of battery power, the clock is caused to count at the programmed rate. And then there is another chip inside which converts the signal into a series of electronic pulses which activate the actual display on the front of the device.
John, you observe that UN and other research indicates the world likely will reach 5.5 billion sometime later this spring. Yet the clock I have here in front of me as we speak already reads 5.5 billion and counting. I'm not sure I understand how this is.
The number is symbolic. There is no technology that I know of that could somehow simultaneously count all of the births and deaths going on at any time and then somehow keep track of the actual number, obviously. But the number 5.5 was simply chosen for convenience for the prototypes of the buttons that have been made. There are only two of these that exist right now, and we've been zeroing in on this 5.5 billion number because it is a significant number that we're going to reach in May.
What kinds of reactions have you elicited?
The reaction is one of great interest, I would say. I have been wearing mine now for about a month or so, and I would say the reaction ranges anywhere from sort of shock to some kind of a visceral reaction that would indicate a deeper understanding of what's going on here. When people read in the newspaper, for instance, that the world population is large, or that the world population is 5.5 billion, that number in and of itself doesn't convey very much. The reader may understand that yes, there are a lot of people in the world. The idea behind this is to convey to people the pace at which population is growing on Earth. It's hard to get that from reading it off of a newspaper. And so the reaction is one of a deeper understanding of what's actually going on by virtue of watching these numbers roll in front of your eyes. And when the connection is made between every digit increase in this button and the amount of resources it takes to sustain a human life on the Earth in terms of food, shelter, education, employment, so on and so forth, I think it conveys a greater understanding of just what it takes to sustain human life on the planet.
John Helwig, inventor and designer and founder of Terra Tech Design in Berkeley, California. His device is a 2-inch diameter digital watch-like button with a liquid crystal display counting the numbers by which the world's population of humans is increasing. There are only two of these in existence to date. Helwig is looking for funding to mass produce the counters. This is Bruce Robertson. 5,501,581,798, 810, 16, 821, 836, 852. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. We had help this week from Jacqueline Virag. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for the Environment Show, program number 162. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible available by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.